You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks so much for joining me. We're joined tonight by Scott Eyman. Scott Eyman is the film historian who wrote the definitive biography of John Wayne that we talked about here a couple of years ago, and he's also the author of Print the Legend, The Life and Times of John Ford, and books about Mary Pickford, Louis B. Mayer, Ernst Lubitsch, and many others. His new book is Hank and Jim, The 50-Year Friendship of Henry Fonda and James Stewart. Scott Eyman, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, it's good to be back, Gary. Thanks for having me.
You know, in today's climate of harsh division, liberals and conservatives, they find it almost impossible to be friends. People with differing opinions are rabidly unfriending those with whom they disagree. But Jimmy Stewart and Henry Fonda, they couldn't have been more different when it came to politics or religion. And yet?
Well, it was a different time, and they were a different generation. They had deep-seated disagreements regarding politics. Jimmy Stewart was a conservative Republican, and Henry Fonda was a liberal Democrat. And it didn't really come up until about 1947 with the House Un-American Activities Committee. It started subpoenaing communists, suspected communists, extreme liberals, and premature anti-fascists. They had a serious, serious, loud, volatile disagreement for the first time in their relationship, which at that point was 17 years old. And it got loud, it got heated, and they both realized that they were stomping around very thin emotional ice. And they made a mutual decision to never talk about politics again, that they valued their relationship and their friendship much more than they valued their identification with their individual politics. So they simply tabled it, and it never came up. And for the rest of their lives, they avoided it. And when the Vietnam War came along and Jane Fonda's activities made her the La Passionara of the anti-war movement, you know, reporters would bait Jimmy Stewart constantly with questions about his goddaughter, because Stewart was goddaughter to both of Fonda's children. They, to this day, they refer to Stewart as Uncle Jimmy, you know. And he never took the bait. He always kept. He simply would say, I don't talk about politics, I don't talk about my goddaughter, I love her very much, you know.
Well, I guess we can take a page from that, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not a bad idea, you know, because if you agree about 80% of things, why focus on the 20% you don't agree on?
Although that's a kind of an important 20%.
No question. But on the other hand, how important is the friendship? You know,
what about?
I have a very good friend who voted for Donald Trump, and you know, we rode out Hurricane Irma together. But we haven't discussed politics since before the election. But we rode out Hurricane Irma together and had a fine time, as fine a time as you can have while riding out a hurricane.
Now, what about their religious differences? I mean, Jimmy Stewart was a religious guy, Henry Fonda not so much.
Exactly. Fonda was raised in a Christian Science household, which he kind of paid attention to for a while, and then paid no attention to whatsoever for the rest of his life, or to any other religion, and he simply didn't believe in the tenets of organized religion. He didn't believe there was an afterlife, and he told his wife that when he died, she should just cremate him and throw his ashes in the pile. You know, that it would make good fertilizer for his beloved plants, and he meant it. I mean, everybody says that. I don't care what you do with me when I'm dead, but Fonda really meant it.
But they didn't have any problems. That was never an issue.
No. It was more of an issue in the Stewart family, because Stewart went to church every Sunday, and his wife and children didn't particularly. And he regarded that as one of his signal failings in life, that he had failed to transmit his own passion for his Presbyterian religion to his wife and children. And he was not happy about it. It wasn't something that he just rolled over and went on with his life. It really bothered him. But that was the way it was. He had to learn to live with it.
Well, Scott Eyman, what about Henry Fonda and Jimmy Stewart's approach to acting? Did they have different approaches there?
No, they were very similar in their approaches to acting. They had all these superficial differences, or semi-superficial differences. I mean, Fonda had five wives and Stewart had one. And Fonda had fraught relationships with his children, and Stewart didn't particularly. He got along fine with his children. But on the deepest level of their attitude towards their craft, they were very similar. Neither one of them ever had an acting lesson. They both believed in learning the script backwards and forwards and respecting the script. Otherwise, why are you doing the project? Why do the play? Why do that movie if the script is something you're just weaving little curlicues of personality around? They didn't like the method. They didn't trust the method, especially Fonda, who had more of a conflict with it because of his daughter Jane, who was a method actress and applied the method. But he thought the whole thing about bringing up sense memory, similar things that happened to you in your life, similar to the character, so that you could portray that character's emotions more authentically, was an evasion of acting. If you're going to do that, what they call it acting, you're supposed to be able to imagine the emotions, not necessarily dredge up your own emotions. He thought it was pointless, and Stewart did too. So they had, and look the other actor in the eye, learn the lines, respect the script, do the just focus, concentrate. You know, they didn't believe in all that newfangled stuff that came along in the 50s with Brando and Jimmy Dean and Monty Clift. It was a generational conflict, classic generational conflict, really. You know, what they did worked for them. What Clift and Dean and Brando did worked for them, you know.
Do you have an opinion as to which was it the better actor, Jimmy Stewart or Henry Fonda?
They were totally different kinds of actors. Stewart was an actor of elaboration. He was extremely emotional, extremely expressive. He was a big actor in the same way that Jimmy Cagney was a big actor. But like Jimmy Cagney, he was never a false actor. You know, he was big but true. Fonda was 180 degrees. He was compression. He was subtlety. Fonda communicated with the raise of an eyebrow or the glint of an eye. It was all very subterranean with Fonda. You had to really watch him carefully. I think I say in the book that Fonda was the only American actor who could have worked for Ozu, you know. He was just, they were just different kinds of actors. When they worked together, the interesting thing is how well they worked together, even though they're both staying true to their own artistic personalities, you know. What you see when they work together is this extraordinary rapport and an almost musical sense of each other's timing. They're like musicians who can play together and work off of each other. And Stewart will throw him a moment, and Fonda will do it, and then toss it back to Stewart. And it's really like watching a couple of great jazz musicians just throw solos back and forth at each other. They're just delicious to watch.
Well, they are both great actors, and they both made great films, and I guess they both made some not so great films in their careers. They're really, you know, up in the upper echelon of great stars like John Wayne, who you wrote about, and Fonda and Stewart and Wayne too, to a certain extent, and you talk about this in the book, have been kind of accused of being the actors who are the same all the time, or they just play themselves, or not really acting, and Jimmy Stewart had kind of a profound response to that.
Well, he said playing yourself is no easy thing. You're surrounded by a camera, you're surrounded by 80 or 90 technicians, all of them are staring at you, and you have to pretend to be casual, pretend to be real in a completely unreal situation, which is the ultimate enigma of acting, you know. There is nothing realistic about what the actor is actually doing and the circumstances in which the actor is performing. But they have to give the impression that it's the most natural thing in the world, that the audience sitting there could look at them and say, well, I could do that. And, of course, you can't. When you watch an amateur actor work with a professional actor, there's really no doubt about who's who.
I guess like Glenn Campbell in True Grit.
Yeah, exactly. Who was not a natural actor and made two movies and got out of the movie business, appropriately enough, before the movie business dumped him. Because he, and Glenn Campbell's a wonderful, a superb musician, you know, one of the great studio musicians of of his generation. And God knows, a superb singer. But no, he was not an actor by any stretch of the imagination. And it became obvious when he's working with John Wayne, who, of course, ironically had the reputation of only playing himself. Actually, John Wayne's an extraordinarily skilled screen actor. You know, and the difference between an absolute hardcore professional like Wayne working with Glenn Campbell, who didn't have a clue, was painful at times in that. Otherwise, very good movie.
Yeah. Well, you know, you've written about John Wayne, famously, and you've written about now Henry Fonda and Jimmy Stewart, and you wrote a great book about John Ford, and all three of those actors worked with John Ford. Are you kind of following a thread that started with your John Ford book, or actually started even earlier?
No. Well, the Ford book came first, and I had no intention of writing a book about John Wayne, even though it was the obvious follow-up. Because I didn't want to, because I felt I'd done my duty in Monument Valley, done my time in Monument Valley by writing the Ford book. The Ford book took 6 years, and it was six difficult years. Ultimately, eventually, more than, 12, 13 years later, I decided to do a book on John Wayne. But it was a decision I was reluctant, I made reluctantly. No, it has nothing to do with it. What led me to the Fonda Stewart book was I wanted to write a book I hadn't already written. I wanted to do something I hadn't done. And this is, in terms of the milieu and the generation, yeah, it's the same generation. But I've never written a book. It's not really a dual biography. It's more intimate than that. It's more closely focused than that. It's a biography of a friendship, basically, between two legendary movie stars. And legendary movie stars generally don't have friendships with another movie star that lasts for 50 years, because being a movie star is an itinerant profession, and you work with someone for 8 or 10 weeks and you have a good time and you say, well, let's keep in touch, but your career takes you in totally different directions and you never see each other again, and I suppose it's easy to maintain a semblance of contact now with emails and things, but these guys bonded in a way that was very unusual. And they stayed bonded in spite of the vicissitudes of life and their political differences and the fact that Fonda left Hollywood in 1947 to go to New York and reinvent himself as a stage actor. And did so very successfully. And he didn't go back to Hollywood until Mr. Roberts in 1955, but he didn't move back to Hollywood until 1963. He was a New York guy for over 15 years and loved New York. And never really got acclimated to the movie business. He was not a movie guy, particularly. A lot of his movies he never saw, and he could count the number of Fonda movies that he liked on two hands, really.
Did Jimmy Stewart like his films?
Stewart loved the movie business. Fonda was much more ambivalent about the movie business. Stewart loved the movie business. He thought the movie business was the ultimate. And was very content to make movies. He had no particular desire to go back to the stage until old age, when movie parts dried up, and he did Harvey on stage because he was comfortable with the play, because he'd done the play in the 1940s, taking over from Frank Fay, who created the role, on his summer vacation as a screen test for the movie, basically, doing a test for the movie, and he actually made the movie in 1949, 1950. But except for going back to do Harvey in New York and London and taping it for television, he never had any particular interest in doing stage work. And after the success of the Harvey revival, he had a lot of offers. Josh Logan came at him with On Borrowed Time, and everybody ran scripts past Stewart. He really didn't want to work. He didn't want to go on stage, and he didn't really want to work anymore. His zest for show business was draining away by that time.
They did, Fonda and Stewart lived together in Hollywood at some point, and you kind of talk about this in the book. I mean, were there rumors about them being gay, with two men living together? And
Oh, sure. They lived together in New York from 1932 to 1935. Then Fonda went to Hollywood, and Stewart followed about 6 months later. And they lived together in Hollywood for a couple of years until Fonda got married to the mother of Jane and Peter Fonda. And when they came back from the war in 1945, Stewart moved in with Fonda again and lived in Jane and Peter's playhouse, because Stewart's house
had been
leased.
Must have been a big playhouse.
Yeah. Stewart's house had been leased, and the lease wasn't up for 6 months. So he had to find another place to live. So Fonda said, well, come on and live with me again. So he stayed in Jane and Peter's playhouse while Jane and Peter moved into the guest room of the house. Orson Welles came out to Hollywood for a screen test in 1937. And he'd seen Fonda and Stewart on screen, and he'd heard that they were living together. And some people were talking, you know, about, well, these two guys are living together. And, you know, they always raised eyebrows, whether it was Cary Grant and Randall Scott or David Niven and Errol Flynn. Well, maybe not with David Niven and Errol Flynn, but it often raised eyebrows. And Welles said that before he got out to Hollywood, he thought that they were either the two straightest human beings alive or it was the hottest affair in town. And then he met them in Hollywood, and he realized they were the two straightest beings alive. So that was the end of that rumor.
Well, then Randall Scott and Cary Grant, they were romantically involved, weren't they?
Well, that's the story. That's the story. I wasn't there. I'm old, but I'm not that old.
That's your next book. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro. Tonight we're talking with Scott Eyman. He's the author of a new book called Hank and Jim, The 50-Year Friendship of Henry Fonda and James Stewart. Scott Eyman has also written many books, including books about John Wayne and John Ford. Now, I know that you're friends with Robert Wagner. He's been on the show here, and you co-wrote his autobiographies with him, and they're wonderful books. People should read them. Although I don't think I love Robert Wagner, and I don't think he's as great an actor as either Fonda or Stewart, but
he'd agree with you.
He's had great success. He's had success on the stage. He's had success in films, many, many fine films. And unlike Jimmy Stewart and Henry Fonda, he's had great success in television. He was, he had two great television series that were both long lasting.
Right.
And what I wonder, is there a different kind of acting that makes, I mean, very few actors have done what Robert Wagner has done. There's there's good actors like David Janssen. He's a terrific actor in television, terrible in the movies, as in The Green Berets. And there's Robert Wagner and there's James Garner. Those are the two actors I can think of that have been able to move back and forth. There are actors like Clint Eastwood and Steve McQueen who start on TV, then they go to movies. But why Henry Fonda and Jimmy Stewart both tried television a few times, and all of their attempts were really bad. Why were they so bad on television?
Well, they were. The problem was they were preceded by their reputations and by the audience's preconceptions of them. And in a sense, I think they were both too big for the medium. And this was television in the 60s and 70s. Most, I believe that all their attempts were all in the 60s, actually. All, no, it was 60s and 70s. And it was the sort of thing. It was kind of a desperation move on both their parts because they weren't ready to retire, but the great parts in movies simply weren't showing up anymore, you know? So, and they wanted to stay busy. So nowadays, of course, you've got different levels. You could go to work at HBO. You can do movies at HBO. You could do things at Showtime. You know, there's all sorts of venues for actors who are maybe not necessarily the first call for big feature motion pictures.
The difference between movies and television is not quite what it was then.
No, it's drawn much closer as movies have gotten cheesier and television's gotten better. But they were both far too big for the television medium as it was constituted at that time. And the shows were trite. You know, they were cookie cutter shows. Fonda did a Western in 1959, where he was a sheriff and a young deputy. And it was like, it was not radically dissimilar from any of the 30 other Westerns that were on television at the time. And Stewart did a sitcom where he played an absent-minded college professor. Well, he's too good of an actor to do that, you know? People thought too much of him, and it was a kind of diminishment of his role and of the affection people had for him. And then he did a show, an hour-and-a-half show called Hawkins for the Defense, which was a riff on Anatomy of the Murder. His character in Anatomy of Murder, where he doesn't seem to be up with it, but he has a way of winning his cases. You know, he's kind of this backwoods lawyer. And it would become a very successful show when it was rejiggered for Andy Griffith and called Matlock. It was the same show. It was exactly the same show. And Jimmy Stewart bombed out with it, and Andy Griffith ran for 10 or 12 years with it.
Andy Griffith's show did not have particularly better writing than Hawkins. I mean, Hawkins had Strother Martin in the cast.
It
was an enjoyable show, but it just wasn't very good.
No, it wasn't very good. And the Andy Williams show was cookie cutter, too. I mean, Andy Griffith's show was cookie cutter, too. But Andy Griffith was a guy that audiences were used to seeing on television, you know, from the Andy Griffith. And Andy Griffith was never particularly successful in the movies. You know, Face in the Crowd is a good movie, and people love it now, but it was a flop at the time, commercial flop at the time. Onion Head, no. No Time for Sergeants did okay. He found his métier, he found his level on the Andy Griffith Show on television in the 60s, and he became part of everybody's household. Stewart had some of the same folksy quality, but he was such a good actor and capable of so much more that there was a disconnect between what the audience knew he could do, because they'd seen Rear Window, they'd seen Vertigo, they'd seen Anatomy of a Murder, and here he is playing, you know, an absent-minded college professor with two kids. You know, where, a part Brian Keith could have walked through, you know, and you're going to put Jimmy Stewart in this? It was just a bad idea.
The Smith family with Henry Fonda was particularly stiff and awkward.
Oh, he hated that show. He was embarrassed by that show.
So was I.
Embarrassed by that show. You know, and it had a laugh track. I mean, it was just, it was an error in judgment on Fonda's part. It was an error in judgment. You can't call it anything else.
Scott Eyman, both James Stewart and Henry Fonda were directed by John Ford and by Alfred Hitchcock. What kinds of experiences did they have with those two directors?
Well, Hitchcock liked Stewart a lot. Stewart was his second favorite actor after Cary Grant. Cary Grant was always number one with Hitchcock because he didn't have to be directed. You know, you just didn't have to tell him anything. He knew how to present himself. He knew how to stand. He knew how to play the scene. And Hitchcock didn't want to talk to actors if he could avoid it. And he didn't need to talk to Cary Grant. And he hardly ever had to talk to Jimmy Stewart either, you know? And they did great work together. I mean, they did Rope, which isn't a great picture, but it's certainly an interesting picture. They did Rear Window, which is one of the best things Hitchcock ever did. And they did Vertigo, which is a major classic now. Flop in 1958.
Now it tops the list of all-time great movies. Tops.
Well, that's insane. That's just insane. It's good. But it's not that good, you know, come on. I mean, I've never really bought the plot at all. It could never happen, ever, not in the world, you know. And Hitchcock's great gift is to make you accept things that you'd roll your eyes over, you know, in the real world. But I think in Vertigo he goes one toke over that line. I sit there watching a movie and I go, come on, this has never happened. This is way too complicated for a murder plot, you know? It would never work. But because it's shot in a kind of subjective, intense, romantic, emotional way, it kind of takes on the atmosphere of a living dream. So, you know, people buy it. They didn't buy it in 1958. They bought it, you know, in the 80s and 90s when the film got reissued and people started looking at it again.
The most unbelievable.
Stewart loved Hitchcock. He loved working for him. He desperately wanted to do North by Northwest, but Vertigo had flopped, and Hitchcock thought it was because Stewart looked too old, which is ridiculous, but Hitchcock was looking for an excuse. So he hired Cary Grant for it, had to pay him, you know, more money than he was going to pay Stewart, but he didn't care, and the result was a huge hit. He only worked the one time with Fonda on The Wrong Man, which is one of the only Hitchcock films that doesn't seem like a Hitchcock movie, where the movie doesn't stop once or twice for these virtuoso sequences to remind you about who directed the movie, as if you could forget. It's a neorealist, black and white, grim, grim, true story. And Fonda is at his best, because he's haunted, he's guilty. He's not guilty of the crime he's chosen, he's being prosecuted for, but he feels guilty. You know, he feels the walls closing in, and on some level, he feels he deserves it. And he can't even mount a successful offense against what's being done to him. It's a haunting movie, and I think it works as well as it does because both Hitchcock and Fonda were utter control freaks, total control freaks. And this movie is the utter, ultimate nightmare for a control freak, because everything is taken away from him, and he hasn't done anything to deserve it. Anything. It's completely malignant fate. He liked the movie. Fonda liked the movie, and he liked very few of his own movies. You could count the movies Fonda liked on 7 or 8 fingers.
And what about working with John Ford? Now, Ford was pretty hard on Duke Wayne, according to your books. Was he hard?
He specialized in being hard on Duke Wayne.
What about
that was his secondary job after making the movie. Making the movie was the first task. The second task was to make Duke Wayne's life miserable.
Was he as hard on Fonda or Stewart?
No, not at all. No, he was not as hard on anybody as he was on Duke Wayne. No, he treated Fonda extremely well on all their pictures together until Mr. Roberts, when they had a disagreement. Fonda had played Mr. Roberts on stage for 2 years in New York and 1 year on tour. And he was proprietary about the script. He was proprietary about the character. You know, he had very strong, he knew where every joke was. He knew where every dramatic moment was. And they got to Midway Island to shoot the locations, and Ford was directing it like a South Pacific, like the guys, the sailors are about to break into There's Nothing Like a Dane. And it was, Fonda thought it was too broad, and that Ford was absolutely misinterpreting the material. And Ford could tell, because Ford had incredible antenna, that Fonda was not happy. So he called a meeting, and he said, "What's the problem?" And Fonda started explaining what didn't like about what Ford was doing. And Ford launched himself over the desk and slugged Fonda, sucker punched him, which Fonda didn't see coming. I mean, he knocked him over, and Ford started windmilling at him, and Fonda was holding him down, trying to stop it, Pappy, stop it. Well, they got the film made, you know, but the relationship was over with a capital O. And they had been very close comrades; they'd been social friends. I personally think Fonda went into the Navy because John Ford was in the Navy. Because Ford was a Navy man. I think that's why Fonda went in the Navy in World War II. They were very, very close, second only to Ford's relationship with John Wayne. But Fonda had challenged him, had challenged Ford on a level that Ford simply could not deal with, you know, and he exploded. And it was unforgivable. And Ford started drinking on the set after that, drinking a case of beer a day, until his gallbladder blew up, and he had to leave the picture, and they had to bring in Mervyn LeRoy to finish it. And Fonda always hated the picture. And it's not a very good picture, but it made a lot of money, and made Fonda a movie star again, even though he had been away from Hollywood for, what, 9 years, 8, 9 years at that point.
Well, I never saw it.
And Ford was very respectful, to answer the rest of your question. Ford was very respectful of Stewart. He didn't give Stewart a hard time at all.
I never saw Mr. Roberts on the stage, but I did. I mean, I like the film because it's such a great story, and and Fonda's great, and also Jack Lemmon and James Cagney and William Powell. I love William Powell in that.
I love William Powell. William Powell was so underrated.
Yeah, he really was. But I do remember hearing Fonda complain about the movie in an interview, I don't know, Dick Cavett or something, saying that if one nurse is funny on the stage, then they thought 10 nurses would be funnier in the movie.
Exactly. Yeah, they turned it into a broad service comedy. And it was not a broad service comedy. It was a comedy drama, emphasis, a kind of 50-50, actually. And he felt Ford really overloaded the comedy part.
Well, you don't talk about this in your book, and we're talking with Scott Eyman, and he's the author of a new book about Henry Fonda and Jimmy Stewart called Hank and Jim, the 50-Year Friendship of Henry Fonda and Jimmy Stewart. You don't talk about radio, although both actors appeared on radio, and Jimmy Stewart had his own radio series, the Six Gun, which I thought was a pretty good series. What was their opinion of radio acting?
It was a way to pick up some extra money. You know, and it didn't require a lot of work. It was basically 2 days a week. And if you're not working in a picture, that's not bad. You know, you go in for a rehearsal, a read-through. You do some fine-tuning in the script. You do a dress rehearsal, and then you do the show. You know, it was not heavy lifting, and it was fairly well paid. I don't think either one of them took radio terribly seriously. Radio was only taken seriously by the younger generation of people who were using it as a stepping stone. You know, Orson Welles in the 30s, who was using it as a stepping stone to, A, finance the Mercury Theater on Broadway, and then to get to Hollywood, you know. And he would go back to radio on occasion because he liked radio. But there was never any question as to which was the wife and which was the mistress. Movies were always going to be, you know, his main thing, Welles' main thing, even though he had, God knows, a turbulent time making his films. I don't think either Fonda or Stewart really cared about, because they were both, Jane Fonda told me this interesting thing. She said, you know, these were not goofy guys. They were both Uncle Jimmy and my father were very serious men, she told me. She said, but when they got together, goofy could break out. And but left to their own devices, they weren't a lot of laughs, generally. You know, the atmosphere was fairly serious around both of them.
Well, there are some negative things about them that come up in your book that I wanted to ask about. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that Henry Fonda was married 5 times. And mm-hmm. I talked to Gore Vidal once, who collaborated with Henry Fonda on The Best Man.
Mm-hmm.
And he characterized Fonda as a skirt chaser or a womanizer.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that was accurate?
When he wasn't married, yes. Yeah, he was not averse to looking for the next wife. but, you know, Fonda was a priest, and his church was the acting. He wasn't really emotionally invested in anything except acting, to be honest. And I think he would have been the first to admit it, if you couch the question that way.
So that made him a bad husband and a bad father?
It made him a distracted husband and a distracted father. He wasn't always a bad father. He was a distracted husband. And I think in his mind, domestic things like wives and children were an imposition because they distracted him from what he really cared about the most, which was acting. That's really all he thought about, you know. Stewart was was not anywhere near as obsessed with acting. It was a job. He was serious about it, extremely serious about it, but it was not the sum and totality of his life by any stretch of the imagination.
But he was good at playing obsessed guys in the movies, like those westerns that he did with Anthony
mm-hmm.
Mann or...
Mm-hmm.
or
With the exception of The Shop Around the Corner, which he made in 1940 before the war, I think Fonda matured as an actor before Stewart did. I think Fonda, when you look at Fonda in Young Mr. Lincoln and Grapes of Wrath, those are great performances. I don't think he could have gotten closer to them in 1948 or 1950. The war was the making of Stewart as an actor. His stuff after the war is far superior to his work before the war, I think. Before the war, as I said, except for the Lubitsch film, he's very charming and he's very sweet and he's kind of sexy in a strange way, but he's also kind of gawky and relying on his gawky charm, what he was already conscious of as his gawky charm. He doesn't get serious and get level and get intent and get tough until after the war, because the war gave him experiences that he probably would not have been able to access and process if he hadn't been an actor. But it gave him a sense of anxiety and a sense of anger and a sense of bitterness that he simply wouldn't have been able to express had he been in any other field other than acting.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro, and we're talking tonight with Scott Eyman about his new book, Hank and Jim, The 50-Year Friendship of Henry Fonda and James Stewart. Scott Eyman has also written many books, including books about John Wayne and John Ford. Well, the two of them, when they acted together, it kind of felt like they were slumming. I mean, the movies they made together are not the highest caliber. The only one I really remember is The Cheyenne Social Club.
They were simply opportunities to work together. They never got a good script that offered each of them a good part. It just never happened. They're all kind of Fire Creek is a kind of B Western made by guys refugees from Gunsmoke. Literally, that's what these guys were doing. They did Gunsmoke, and they put the script together. And it plays like a Gunsmoke episode, basically. Cheyenne Social Club is a jokey Western, the sort of thing that Burt Kennedy was making for a number of years. And this one's directed by Gene Kelly. Because, of course, if you're going to have a comedy Western, Gene Kelly's the first person you think of. You know, this is the kind of insane thinking that, you know, you occasionally find in Hollywood. Hire Richard Attenborough to direct a Chorus Line. Of course, why not? Hire Gene Kelly to direct a comic Western with Henry Fonda and Jimmy Stewart. Why didn't I think of that? Yeah. The one thing they did that is actually very charming is their segment in the omnibus film Honor Mary Way, where they play not terribly bright and not terribly good musicians trying to scare up enough money to get their truck repaired so they can get to the next gig. And it was written by John O'Hara, and it was directed by George Stevens. And it's really very funny, very funny. And you really do get a sense of their rapport as actors and as men.
So a missed opportunity, especially that the one that Bogdanovich was trying to make.
Oh, Streets of Laredo. Yeah, very sad, very sad, very sad. It was a big Western that Bogdanovich wrote with Larry McMurtry. He wanted to cast John Wayne, Jimmy Stewart, and Henry Fonda in the three lead parts. And Fonda and Stewart said, yeah, we'll do it. Sure, we're good. Just tell us when you want to show up. And Wayne shied away. And they couldn't finance it. It was an expensive picture, and they couldn't finance it without Wayne. Fonda and Stewart weren't considered strong enough at that point. This is like 1971 or something, 72. To finance the picture of that size. So it didn't happen. So Larry McMurtry took the script and rewrote it and turned it into a novel called Lonesome Dove, which is a magnificent novel.
Well, which part was going to be for who? I mean, who was going to play Gus and who was going to play Jake Spoon?
Wayne was going to have the Duvall part. I don't know the part Robert Duvall played.
Yeah.
And I don't know which of them was going to play the Tommy Lee Jones part, you know? It would have been magnificent. You know, it's a different movie because you had to take into account their age, you know. And it was going to be a 2-hour picture as opposed to an 800-page novel and an 8 or 10-hour miniseries. So it's obviously was going to be a more compressed narrative. And Bogdanovich, when I talked about it, he said Wayne might have been getting, didn't want to play, maybe Wayne didn't want to play the crabby old guy anymore. You know, maybe he wanted to do something else. Actually, I think Wayne, I don't know that Wayne trusted Bogdanovich, because Ford would say nice things to Bogdanovich's face, but to Wayne, he was much less enthusiastic about Bogdanovich when he was talking to somebody else other than Bogdanovich. And he might have scared Wayne off the picture. Who knows?
I love that scene in Bogdanovich's documentary directed by John Ford, in which Bogdanovich asks John Ford this elaborate question, and Ford says, cut!
Yeah! Well, he wasn't even going to try. What are you going to try to answer a question then? No, just
not. Jimmy Stewart missed out on To Kill a Mockingbird, and why did he shy away from that role, you believe?
I think he was uncomfortable with the racial politics. You know, his wife thought he made a terrible mistake. His wife thought he would have been much better in the part than Gregory Peck was. I think he was a better actor than Gregory Peck was, but I also think he might have been too old for the part. You know, Gregory Peck is like 10 or 12 years younger than Jimmy Stewart was, and he's more believable as the father of an 8-year-old girl, it seems to me, than Jimmy Stewart would have been at that age. That said, you know, who knows? But his wife always thought that was that he made a terrible mistake in turning it down.
So, do you feel that Jimmy Stewart held some prejudice about black people?
I think he was uncomfortable with the 1960s and the 1970s in a way that Henry Fonda was not. Remember, Stewart was a conservative Republican. He was an Air Force pilot who flew B-24s over Germany and Belgium and France during World War II, 19 missions. He was a brilliant commander, a brilliant pilot, and a very serious patriot. So he's not going to be able to process the public rage over Vietnam. And he lost a child in Vietnam. His stepson was killed in Vietnam. he was in the Marines, and he got shot in the chest. It was a devastating blow to him. And he was simply not going to be able to roll with the kinds of things that were going on in the 60s and 70s, whether it was burning the flag or protesting the war or you name it. He just didn't. He felt alienated from his own country at that point. And at some point, almost everybody in every generation feels alienated from their own country. Look around now. So this is our time to be alienated from our country. The 60s and the early 70s were Jimmy Stewart's time to be alienated from his country.
Do you think he had? Do you think he had any problem being in a industry that was run by Jews? I mean, there's some people who believe that.
No. He loved Louis B. Mayer. Mm-hmm. He loved those guys. He loved Harry Cohn. He had no problem whatever with the moguls that ran the studios. He thought they actually did, for the most part, a very good job in finding talent, in managing talent, in focusing talent, and in raising talent to the next level.
He liked the studio
system.
Problems.
He had zero problems with those guys. Fonda didn't particularly like the movie business. And he didn't like the movie business because there were some... This is my gut feeling. He never said this in so many words. He preferred the stage because when the curtain goes up, there's the actor and there's the audience. There's nobody else. There's nobody else to get in the way between the actor and the audience. In movies, there's dozens of people. There's the cameraman. There's the director. There's the studio that might want to do things. There's the composer who might mess up a scene with a bad music cue. There's all sorts of things that can get in between the actor's intent and the results that the audience sees on the screen, and that's the sort of thing that drove the lack of control drove Fonda nuts because he was a control freak, and Stewart wasn't particularly a control freak except when he was behind the controls of a B-24.
Yes, he could fly a plane, but he couldn't drive a car very well.
That's true. Stewart's kids told me that. He was a terrible driver. He drove a boxy old Volvo for 15 years, which he refused to get rid of. His wife was always nudging him, do this. He wouldn't get rid of it because they had headroom, you know? And he was comfortable in it. And he wore clothes until they wore out. He'd still be wearing clothes. You know, he was just kind of an old shoe guy. And, I mean, he lived well. He was extraordinarily wealthy. He was one of the wealthiest actors of his generation, really. But he didn't act like that. He didn't put on that lifestyle. He never adopted that lifestyle. He lived like he had about 5% of the money he actually had.
He did well financially because he was smart enough to take a piece of the action in production and so forth.
Yes, he got percentages of profits. He got percentages of gross, not percentages of net. He would get gross percentage, and he started getting that with It's a Wonderful Life. He made over $300,000 on It's a Wonderful Life between his salary and his percentage. It's a Wonderful Life ended up losing about $350,000 and bankrupted the company, Liberty Films, the production company that Capper started to make it. But Stewart did just fine off of it, you know? And he continued, and in the 1950s, he really didn't have any flops, except for The Spirit of St. Louis, the movie where he played Charles Lindbergh that no one wanted to see. But if you wanted to get Jimmy Stewart into a movie, all you had to do was wave an airplane in the script. And he'd sign up in a heartbeat, you know, because he loved flying and he loved planes and he loved the hardware. He loved the hardware of planes. So he made a lot of aviation movies because of that.
Well, I love this book. It's called Hank and Jim, The 50-Year Friendship of Henry Fonda and Jimmy Stewart. And it set me back to watching a bunch of films and checking out some films I'd never seen before. I watched a Shemp Howard short that Jimmy Stewart was in. I watched Murder Man with Spencer Tracy to see some
Yeah, religion. Yeah. Not a bad little movie.
And I watched 12 Angry Men again the other night. What a great film that is.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it's a wonderful book, and the author is my guest, Scott Eyman. It's such a pleasure to chat with you. Thanks so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, I'm happy to do it, and thanks for being interested in these guys. They're some of my favorite people. ¶¶
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can like us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Scott Iman. His new book, Hank and Jim, The 50-Year Friendship of Henry Fonda and James Stewart. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.